Greetings and welcome to the Journal of Southern Religion podcast. My name is Art Remillard, and today's podcast is being recorded in my academic backyard at St. Francis University in Loretto, Pennsylvania, where we are the host of the 6th annual North American Undergraduate Conference in Religion and Philosophy. The event will begin this evening with a keynote address from one of the JSR's former editors, Randall Stevens. He is a reader in history and American studies at Northumbria University in the UK. Professor Stevens joins us today to discuss his address for this evening, which will come from his 2011 book, The Anointed, Evangelical Truth in a Secular Age, co-authored with Carl Giberson. We'll also ask about his current research on rock music and American Christianity. Randall, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much, Art. It's great to be here.
So the theme for this year's undergraduate conference is the future of reason, and I'm wondering how you are envisioning your talk kicking this discussion off.
So tonight, I'm going to be talking a little bit about a type of anti-intellectualism in America that's especially prevalent among conservative Christians. And there are a lot of ways in America to talk about anti-intellectualism, but we make the case in the book I did with Giberson that conservative Christianity and evangelicalism in particular has produced an array of these counter-experts and leaders, thought leaders, who counter mainstream secular knowledge on a number of topics like science and American history, theology, psychology, which, granted, those are diverse in their range and they don't operate in the same way as a field, but we pinpointed these different individuals, and I'll focus on some of those tonight in the talk.
Well, this is very fitting because I just looked at John Fea's blog, and there was this link to a new one from David Barton. And the long story short is that Barton was making the case that violence done to Indians was actually covered under just war tradition in Christianity. What's your take on this? You know, where does this come from David Barton? And does this surprise you? And what do you make of it within the bigger picture of what Barton has done?
It's surprising and it's extreme because you don't have very many people in the public sphere today who would say that what Americans did to Native Americans in the late 19th century was acceptable. But he seems to be kind of an apologist for how Americans, you know, leaders and just regular Americans acted in the past. And when I interviewed him for the book, I asked him, as a Christian, couldn't you just say, yeah, there were things that were done in the past that you can't conceivably justify as a Christian, and we can learn from that? And he said, well, you could do that, but he told me that he thought that all the ways that America was uniquely Christian were what was so stunning about American history, and he compared it to Europe. I wasn't convinced by that answer, but I think that he has, first and foremost, this idea that he needs to defend the actions of Americans, which the history of that would change, because I think once he would get to Woodrow Wilson and once he would get to Franklin Delano Roosevelt, he wouldn't be interested in that kind of defense. So the advent of modern liberalism is when he kind of changes and takes a different tack. But before that, it seems defensive. Now, the problem with that, too, is it's as if he thinks or has this idea that all of the founding fathers were similar enough in their philosophy and their writing that they can be treated as a whole, which I just don't think that stands as true. And a historian like David Holmes, his book on American founding and religion is so much more nuanced and interesting because it looks at that diversity in that early generation of American founding. It doesn't flatten it out like Barton does.
Let's just move on to the broader purpose of the book, which is to think about how these folks become experts.
I think one of the main things is that they speak the language of evangelical Christianity. They speak a kind of homey, folksy, populist language that really resonates with American believers. I mean, in a way, it sounds pastoral sometimes, the way that they speak. Like if you listen to, there are all these videos of David Barton giving lectures that you can watch on YouTube, or the same with Ken Ham. And they also, there are dog whistles in many of their speeches online that are to remind conservative evangelicals and fundamentalists that they are the ones who are under attack. They're the ones who are on the defensive because of this out-of-control left-wing conspiracy that's trying to, you know, either take away their country or trying to redefine sexuality for the worse. They're charismatic figures that their ideas then have this wide appeal. Plus, all of them have kind of a media empire behind them, which doesn't hurt.
When I think of this notion of a kind of spiritual warfare almost, my mind automatically goes to Francis Schaeffer, who kind of gives us this language of secular humanism, which seems very prevalent in your book as well, with the people that you're dealing with. And I'm wondering if you think that there is a clear line between Francis Schaeffer and the experts that you're dealing with.
Yeah, that's a good point. I think there is a connection. In the chapter we had on David Barton, we looked a little bit at Francis Schaeffer, and then a chapter on the parallel culture of conservative Christianity, we looked at Schaeffer as well. And I mean, the link, I think part of the link is that in the 1980s, Francis Schaeffer had a famous falling out with some evangelical historians who were in the academy, Mark Knoll and George Marsden among them. And this is something that Barry Hankins wrote about in his biography of Francis Schaeffer. And Mark Knoll and George Marsden were worried that Schaeffer was harnessing right-wing politics to history and not letting history speak for itself, or not being true to the nuances of the historical record, but trying to use the past for very specific political purposes in the 1980s for the new right. And Schaeffer thought that they were just being nitpicky, and that they, you know, he viewed it as an attack, and he became very defensive about this. But I think there is a link between someone like Francis Schaeffer and then another conservative historian who died in recent years, Peter Marshall, and then directly also to David Barton.
I want to turn now to thinking about how you research this, because you mentioned that you talked to David Barton and you did a lot of interesting firsthand research for this. And would you talk about going and talking to some of these folks?
Yeah, there's a charm, I think, to Barton that is missing, that maybe people on the left don't quite see. They just see him as this sort of cynical, crass politicizer of history. But, you know, he had a convincing kind of style when you talk to him. And when I saw him on The Daily Show, I think it was his second appearance on The Daily Show, you could see that it wasn't as if Jon Stewart was bowled over by him, but Barton comes equipped with so many facts and tidbits of information. It reminded me of a Bible quizzer. We had these in the Church of the Nazarene. When I grew up in the Church of the Nazarene, they had this Bible quizzing, and you would memorize and get drilled on Scripture. Well, Barton has applied that to all these factoids about the founding period, and some of them are off or exaggerated, like Congress printing the first Bible in America and that kind of stuff. But, you know, there was that, and then I went to focus on the family in Colorado Springs, the conservative family values organization, and at the time, it was still headed by James Dobson. I didn't get past Dobson's handlers, so I could never get an interview with him, even though I'd met him one time a long time ago, because my father actually was a friend of James Dobson Sr. They both taught at the same small college and actually went to hunting and stuff together. So there's a family connection, but I did interview a lot of people that focus on the family, and one was the self-proclaimed Orthodoxy czar, who was in charge of what kind of books and what sort of curriculum they had in their store and online. It was a fun interview. I asked her some questions about what kind of content they would carry, what they wouldn't carry, and it was basically came out that, you know, they certainly wouldn't carry books by evangelical liberals like Tony Campolo or Jim Wallace, but they had a whole section on premillennial theology, and they would have Tim LaHaye books, and they had Ken Ham and creationist materials. And she told me they just tried to carry material that was in the mainstream of Christianity, and I questioned her a little bit about that because of kinds of content I saw there, but I guess it brought up the issue of, you know, what really is mainstream. One person or one group's going to think one thing, another will think a different thing. But in addition to all that, there's enough good literature now about contemporary evangelicalism or evangelicalism since the 60s. It would have helped, actually, to have some of these books that have come out more recently, like Dan Williams' book, God's Own Party, and then Darren Dochuk's book and some others in recent years. But there was still a good amount of secondary source literature, too.
I want to ask about your chapter where you talk about how and why people follow these experts. And you say that there is something in us, something that is deeply rooted in our genes that seeks a trusted leader. And I thought that this was a really interesting thing for a historian to be getting into, this sort of notion of cultural cognition and why we do what we do at that level. I'm wondering if you could talk about the decision to go there and what you learned from doing that.
Much of this was more of my co-author Carl Giberson's within his wheelhouse. But it was interesting learning about, you know, reading some of these articles about cultural cognition and this project at Yale to try to determine how do people make decisions or how do people decide between various views in the public realm. If you're from a conservative Christian family in Arkansas, are you going to believe someone who is a creationist, who speaks like you, has a similar sort of ideas that you have, or someone that you automatically don't trust because maybe they're at an Ivy League institution, and the way that they talk about evolution cues you into their being godless in some way. So it appealed to us to use these arguments, this new kind of work about cultural cognition, and, you know, which combines some aspects of sociology along with even neuroscience, to try to figure that out, why people value or esteem some knowledge and why they reject other knowledge. And I think the critical thing about it, the takeaway of it, is that when you're trying to determine who's telling the truth, the facts of the issue or the proof of the issue isn't necessarily what's most important. Oftentimes it can be more the feel. Does it sound right to you? Is this a person you trust? How is an argument packaged? So like I said, Carl knew a little bit more about that and actually done some, had interacted with people who worked in this area. But it was very interesting to kind of expand out into these other areas of knowledge where, you know, I had been kind of more cloistered in religious studies and history. So it was a stretch for me, but I feel like in the end, it really did sort of assist our argument.
Well, in the stretch, you managed to catch a few people's attention. And just researching for this, I saw that you and Ken Ham seemed to have an interesting exchange going. And can you tell me about maybe Ken Ham or just broader response? Because you wrote in the New York Times as well, and I got to imagine you heard back from some of the people that you were talking about, either directly or indirectly.
With the first book, The Fire Spreads, on Pentecostalism, I was mostly writing about dead people. There was no chance that they were going to come back from the grave and haunt me. But this, especially the op-ed we did in the New York Times, right after that and right before the book came out, there was just a lot of chatter among conservative evangelicals about our argument and about the book, and people saying that we were like reverse fundamentalists. Chuck Colson came out of the woodwork and did a little video online about us. And then we had someone in the National Review talking about what a shame it was, the piece that we wrote, and saying that America was doomed if people at Christian colleges had these kinds of views. And I did a post at one point on the U.S. religion blog, the Religion in American Culture blog, where I kind of thought about some of this press. And it's, you know, you can't help but have it be kind of stressful. I knew from the start that we're writing about these contemporary issues that are hot topics for a lot of people. There's going to be blowback. There was just a lot of email. I guess you could call some of it hate mail that was sent to us from pastors. My favorite one was an email from a pastor who's from Texas. He was using Corinthians to say that knowledge puffs up, and it looked like we were puffed up, but he had all sorts of spelling mistakes in his email, and there were grammatical errors. And I couldn't help, but when I emailed him back, I said, you probably could use some knowledge to help puff you up a little bit. I felt like that was probably a bad move on my part, but I couldn't resist that.
That's great. Speaking of then dead people, I want you to do a comparison for me, because I saw that you wrote the new introduction to Sam Jones's own book from 1886. And Sam Jones is this great evangelical preacher from the South, the Moody of the South, as they called him. And I'm wondering if you can do a comparison over time about these group of evangelical leaders, the experts, in comparison to what we might have seen 100 years ago.
You know, there is a link there, and it was a nice coincidence that I'd worked on that Sam Jones intro right before we got into the thick of the book. And one of the points of contact or the linkages here would be that Sam Jones had crafted this populist style of being folksy and speaking to the average man or woman in the pew and doing it really effectively. And there was one quote I couldn't help but use in the book that Sam Jones, a famous quote of his, he said that we have all these educated preachers nowadays with their degrees, their THDs, their DDs, their PhDs, and their ASSs. And he was tweaking the nose of a rising Christian culture that was more liberal and was attached to the progressive movement, the early stages of the progressive movement. And in his era, though it really doesn't come until after, I think he dies in 1906, in the era right after he dies, that's when there's this split between liberal and conservative Christians, which is one of the highlights of that is, or the lowlights, is the fundamentalist modernist controversy in the 20s. But I think a lot of it begins, at least the populism, which feeds directly into anti-intellectualism because it appeals to what sounds true or witty or more humorous than maybe what actually is true on a certain subject. The difference is that in that era, the late 19th century, some of these areas of human knowledge weren't so politicized like they would become later. Something like creationism really becomes a powerful movement in the 1960s and beyond, maybe because evangelicals in the 60s feel more embattled than they did during the lifespan of Sam Jones. But there are these dividing lines, I think, that are interesting in American religious history. Even though there might be parallels between what happens now and the kind of rhetoric that Sam Jones used, the political and social situation is so different that there's a lot of disconnects as well.
Well, I appreciate that you ended that discussion on the 60s, because I want to pick up with the 60s, because I understand that your newest research project is on rock music, Christianity and rock music, and this actually evolves out of your first book, The Fire Spreads, and I'm wondering if you can kind of give us a preview of things to come before we let you go.
It was the last chapter of The Fire Spreads. My editor at Harvard, Joyce Seltzer, asked me to extend that last chapter and carry the story up to the 20th century, which scared the living daylights out of me because it meant like extending it really far. But I looked a little bit in that chapter at these Pentecostals or people who'd grown up Pentecostal or attended Pentecostal churches regularly in the South, who then went on to become famous rock stars or pop music stars like Elvis Presley, Little Richard, James Brown, Johnny Cash, Tammy Wynette. Some of them were in the field of country music. It just seemed like a fascinating story that hadn't been told fully yet. And now doing research for this new book, it's called The Devil's Music, where I look at those origins, those religious origins of rock, and then I turn to anti-rock and roll. It's just surprising how many links there are between conservative Christianity, Pentecostalism, and rock music. Maybe that's because of how innovative, at least in worship style, Pentecostalism was, the kind of music that they had in services that inspired some parts of rock and roll. And then the story I'm working on now, what I've been doing research on, and was just at Bob Jones University in their fundamentalist collection, is the very hardcore anti-rock and roll argument made in the 60s. So that's another major part of that book. And then using that to try to understand something about evangelicals in the modern era. Why did they crusade so intensely against rock music in the 60s and 70s? What does that say about this movement?
Well, with that, we're going to conclude this podcast. Thank you to Professor Stevens for joining us. To find links to his work, please visit the Journal of Southern Religion website at jsr.fsu.edu. While you're there, you can listen to this and other podcasts, or find us on Facebook, Twitter, and iTunes. Thank you for listening, and have a great day.